You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The United Nations Oil for Food Program calls for limited quantities of Iraqi oil to be exported under strict controls through the Kirkuk pipeline to tankers in the Mediterranean or via the Mina al-Bakar terminal to the Persian Gulf. But over the last 10 years, large quantities of diesel and fuel oil have been smuggled through northern Iraq by truck into eastern Turkey. In the Iraqi border town of Zako, they've been smuggling up to 150,000 tons of diesel oil across the narrow bridge to the Turkish border post of harbor for the last decade. Prothap Chatterjee files this report from a truck stop along the road of Iraq.
A total of 50,000 trucks used to make this border crossing on a regular basis, but in recent months the Turkish government has cracked down on the trade because they fear that the money will fund the movement for autonomy for the Kurdish minority on the border. Ahmed is a pseudonym for a trucker from Gaziantep who has been driving across the border for the last 10 years. He asked that we do not use his real name.
Normally, the trip takes 2 days, but sometimes we wait for 15 days to cross the border because of the war with America. The border guards make our life very difficult. We don't have proper papers. In fact, we are working illegally so the police can stop us, but we have no choice because there are no other jobs. We make just $35 a month. We have no money for food, and we cannot see our families for weeks at a time.
Not everybody has to wait as long. Ahmet Can is another trucker from the Turkish town of Mardin.
If you know somebody at the gate, you don't have to wait that long. You can pay them $100 and you can cross easily, but that would mean we would make a loss because we don't earn that much.
While the men wait, they play games of the truck stops like OK, a common Turkish game that resembles dominoes. Recep Yilmaz is a trucker from Ankara who has been driving on the Iraq road since 1980. He crossed over the border from Iraq into Turkey shortly after the new year.
This time I took some used American, German and Japanese cars like Nissans across the border.
But the money that the Iraqis paid him on the other side was almost worthless.
This is Saddam's money. In 1986, this bill was worth $750. In the 1980s, that money could pay for an entire trip. Today it is worth about $1.50. We can't even buy a Coke in Iraq with this money.
Abdul Kadir Kilij is another driver who has just returned from Iraq, where he sold electric pipes and soft drinks. Unlike the other drivers, he has only been crossing the border for 1 year. He says that even though the truckers from Turkey are very poor, the people on the other side are even poorer.
I was very surprised when I went to northern Iraq. They are really very poor. They cannot even get food to eat. It's really heartbreaking. It would be better if the gate was open so that they can trade with us.
The Turkish government estimates that the sanctions have cost the people of Turkey as much as $30 billion in lost trade. The truckers say that the borders should be open for trade and the sanctions lifted so the people on both sides can earn a decent living. War, on the other hand, they say will make people on both sides of the border suffer even more. Again, Recep Yilmaz.
If somebody gave me a chance, I would definitely go to Washington and say to George Bush, don't go to war with Iraq.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Prothap Chatterjee with Aaron Glantz at the Habur Gate in Turkey on the border with northern Iraq.
Well, as the controversy over North Korea continues to build, there is a bit of puzzlement over why such a small country would seem to defy the U.S. Historical facts, however, support North Korea. International law supports North Korea. Morality supports North Korea. Justice supports North Korea. Bush's declaration that North Korea is part of the axis of evil stands in stark contradiction to the progress taking place in the region today. Is the U.S. immune to international law? Can we pick and choose which treaties we will respect? Peace Watch spoke with North Korean expert Professor Gavin McCormick of Australia National University Research School of Pacific and Asian Studies. McCormick has written extensively on the subjects and debunked the myths of North Korea as a rogue nation and part of the axis of evil.
North Korea is probably it's simplest to say that they're rather desperate on many fronts, economic, political, diplomatic. And this is a cry for attention. It's a cry for to try to bring the United States back to the negotiating table, to get back essentially to the agreement that they did have in 1994, and that that first, in my understanding, was substantially breached by the United States and now has been more or less voided by North Korea.
Remind our listeners what the 1994 agreement contained.
Well, in 1993, there was a real sort of crisis over North Korean development of its project for graphite nuclear-generating reactors, which, as a byproduct, produce plutonium. And the United States' suspicion was that that plutonium was being used for the production of nuclear bombs. So the crisis came to within the brink of war in the spring of 1994. Indeed, it was within one day of the launching of bombing raids on those North Korean suspected nuclear facilities. And at that time, Jimmy Carter intervened and said, look, I'll go to Pyongyang and talk to them and see what can be done. He went. He had a very successful meeting with then-North Korean leader Kim Il-sung. Over a period of several months, it led to the agreement in Geneva in October of 1994, so-called the agreed framework. And under that agreed framework, North Korea would refrain from its graphite-based and therefore plutonium-producing nuclear-generating program. In its place, the United States and its allies would construct a light water reactor or several light water reactors, which would take some years to construct. They were expected to be built by 2003. And in the interim, the United States and its allies would provide 500,000 tons of heavy oil each year to make up the energy shortfall for North Korea in the meantime. That was one section of the agreement. The other part of the agreement for North Korea was extremely important. It was that the United States would move towards normalization of political and economic relations with North Korea, ending a half century of hostile confrontation since the war ended in 1953. And finally, that the United States would issue North Korea with a guarantee of the non-use and the non-use as a threat of nuclear weapons against it. So it was a large and comprehensive agreement. It was a good agreement, but it didn't really last very long.
Hmm. The relationship between North Korea and the U.S. has been tense for decades. The war ended in 1953, but I remember visiting the DMZ in 1985, the demilitarized zone, with a group of journalists from around the world. But the fear was then that even something as seemingly innocuous as a style of clothing might somehow provoke an attack from one of the border militiamen in the zone. And the fact that Bush calls North Korea part of the axis of evil now. So why are we planning to bomb Baghdad and not Pyongyang?
There's an enormous range of complicated economic deals being done between North and South. So South Korea doesn't feel, and South Korea is the country which both knows North Korea best and has suffered most in the past from it. It now doesn't, the surveys say that some 60% of people in South Korea don't feel that there's any threat to them from North Korea. They want to get on with business, get on with normal economic and other relations, and move slowly down the track towards reunification. So I think that's a very important gloss on the American message that North Korea is now a huge threat to the world.
Well,
but coming back to your other question then about what's different between North Korea and Iraq, mm-hmm. I guess there are two major differences. One is that North Korea is next to South Korea, which is supposed to be a major American ally, and it's adjacent to Japan also. And neither South Korea nor Japan want a war. In fact, South Korea has made absolutely clear that it would have nothing of an American attack on its North Korean neighbor. And the newly elected president in South Korea, just elected on the 19th of December, a man called Roh Moo-hyung, he has said that if necessary, he would guarantee North Korea's security. He said he doesn't go along with any ideas of putting pressure on North Korea. Negotiation is the way, negotiated agreement, that's the way forward, not threat or pressure. So 10 years ago during the crisis of, or 9 years ago during the crisis of 1994, South Korea was then under a very conservative president. South Korean opposition to any aggression against North Korea is much stronger now than it was then. So that's the main reason that the United States can't think about going to a war, is because the other major countries in the region would absolutely oppose it.
Hmm. And so should the U.S. be ignoring this saber rattling on the part of North Korea?
No, of course it's extremely important that the present situation not be allowed to go forward much longer. The agreement in 1994 was a good agreement, but what's happened? First of all, you, United States, you promised us light water reactors, which would be constructed by 2003. What is there now? There's just a great hole in the ground. No construction has begun. There's no way in which any energy can be produced except by around the end of this decade. So the United States and its allies are clearly in breach of the Geneva Agreement on that front.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the United States and its allies are in serious breach because they promised North Korea that they would move towards normalization of political and diplomatic relations, and they promised that they would issue a guarantee against any use of nuclear weapons or any use of a threat of nuclear weapons. So those commitments that were made under Clinton in 1994, they, in North Korea's view, they are the basis of a settlement of the issues. And in North Korea's view, it shouldn't be too difficult for the United States to say, well, we agreed to that in 1994, we'll agree to it now. That's all that Pyongyang is asking.
Well, the timing, you have to admit, is certainly suspect. North Korea seems to be thumbing its nose at the Bush administration.
Indeed, yes. There's no question that North Korea is very anxious about timing.
Is there any chance?
But,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes. No, well, I was just going to say that if you can speak about North Korea thumbing its nose at the United States, from a North Korean perspective, and just take for a moment their perspective, when Bush came to power, just after Clinton had been on the brink of making a visit to North Korea, the very earliest Bush statement was that North Korea is part of the axis of evil. At that time, his State Department said North Korea has nothing to do with international terrorism, but Bush called it that. Then his administration then began talking about the entitlement to preemptive attack. So North Korea feels that the nose has been thumbed at them, and they have been rather slow to take up the challenge, but they say they are now taking it up.
Professor and Dr. Gavin McCormick of the Australia National University, the Research School of Pacific and Asian Studies. As President Bush continues to prepare a military message for Iraq, a group of families of victims of September 11th are also en route to Baghdad. Robert Knight spoke with members of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows as they departed New York for Baghdad.
President George Bush told Americans of his memories of September 11th during an address to Congress on September 20th, 2001.
Each of us will remember what happened that day and to whom it happened. We'll remember the moment the news came, where we were, and what we were doing. Some will remember an image of a fire or a story of rescue. Some will carry memories of a face and a voice gone forever. And I will carry this. It is the police shield of a man named George Howard, who died at the World Trade Center trying to save others. It was given to me by his mom, Arlene, as a proud memorial to her son. It is my reminder of lives that ended in a task that does not end.
Documentary filmmaker Terry Rockefeller also suffered a loss on September 11th.
September 11th, my sister, Laura Rockefeller, was working in the World Trade Center in Windows of the World, helping to run a conference on information technology. I actually didn't learn about her death until very late in the day. I had no idea she was going to be there. It was a two-day job. And I think the overwhelming experience of having her killed in that way was at first just to be overcome with the sense that she wasn't supposed to be there and that she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But really coming to terms with that made me appreciate just how much everyone who is an innocent victim of violence is by definition in the wrong place at the wrong time.
While Rockefeller shares the president's remorse over September 11th, she has come to an opposite conclusion regarding the proposed use of force against the nation of Iraq. Accordingly, she, along with three other members of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, are now en route to Baghdad to bring a message of peace.
As people who have lost relatives on September 11th, we feel a deep need to connect with the civilians who might be harmed should war come. We know that the UN inspector's report will be given very soon, and we feel that this is an incredibly important moment to go make a common stand with people that we do not want to see lose relatives, as we have already experienced.
Traveling with Rockefeller is Omaha student Kathleen Tinley.
My uncle was on the 100th floor World Trade Center, and we knew fairly immediately because he had called his sister just a few hours before because she was living in New York at the time. We knew that he was there. And for months, September 11th, 2001, was the day that my uncle died. It wasn't about an attack on America. It was dealing with the fact that Mike wouldn't be around for another Christmas. And that we had lost an amazing person, and thousands of other families lost amazing people. And now, seeing it as the violent act that it was, just pushes me to prevent future violence.
Rockefeller had some diplomatic advice for the president as she departed from New York for a humanitarian mission to what could be a new ground zero in Baghdad.
I guess I would say that as someone who's had the experience of loss because of incredible violence and incredible hatred, I now want to see my country do everything that's possible to be a leader in fostering the kind of international diplomacy and international relations that will work to prevent these things from happening in the future, that will work to prevent terrorism and to prevent wars in the future. I'm going to Iraq to meet with people like me, to let them know that there are people in America who are concerned about their welfare. I hope that that kind of person-to-person contact can happen at all levels of society, that diplomats and politicians throughout the Middle East, from America, with working within the United Nations, working through all appropriate channels, and professionals, perhaps, you know, crossing international boundaries, that if we have more people-to-people contact, we can diffuse tension. I do worry that violence leads to more violence, and by my act, I'm trying to say, perhaps people-to-people communication, really listening to each other, can lead to peace.
Neither is Rockefeller impressed with the Bush administration's claim that an invasion of the cash-poor and oil-rich nation is actually in the best interest of the people of Iraq.
We are not naive. We don't imagine that the lives of the Iraqi people are what they deserve under this regime. We don't believe that they have, you know, the freedoms and the And in fact, the quality of life that they deserve to have. But I would argue that bombing a country is not the way to begin building freedom and democracy. The people in Iraq have already experienced terrific destruction of their homeland. They don't need to be trying to build a society with even less They need to start building a good society now.
Rockefeller, Tinley, and two other members of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows will tour Iraq for a week in hopes that interpersonal commiseration between people can prevent a military response in which the visitors could yet face the future loss of the new friends they intend to make this month in Iraq. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
Someday we will see. Once we get past man's ignorance and tragedy, lay, 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 lay. What about the babies who are young and small?
And now, on a lighter note, we turn to composer, percussionist, and arts activist Cahil El-Zabar of Chicago, Illinois, for his unique perspective on the impending war on Iraq.
Our future is perpetuated by our idea of sharing a legacy. And if that legacy is one of war, there won't be a future for the babies. If it is a legacy of culture, humanity, of thought, the inspiration of positive intellect, and then the overall love, you know, for life and all of its blessings, if we can leave that legacy, then we do indeed share something valuable with our children. We have to be reminded of it, because in our zealous self-importance, we forget that through our actions, we either perpetuate the best of life or we deter from that. I would like to be one and connected to others who perpetuate a future for our children.
You, Cahil, have been writing songs, composing, performing as a percussionist and arts activist for many decades now, some three decades plus. The song that you wrote, Peace on Earth, was actually written 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Are there political events at this time that would inspire or that would be akin to that same feeling in that song, Peace on Earth?
We have, throughout the world, you know, a variety of issues that are generated from what I would call the specific proletariats, the controlling war machines, the political machines that are using media to dictate their opinions and their values on this planet. And here is an opportunity for the folks who understand that we are beyond the idea of all of these confrontations and the military arms and the sense of pushing power through a military presence, that there is a world beyond that. And the idea of that song 20 years ago, I think, is still relevant toward our sense of responsibility to work toward peace, to speak to the issues, to help one another with the advent of technology to communicate and recognize that there is no future world unless there is peace. From that perspective, I think that, you know, the song is still relevant.
You've written a more recent song about peace titled One World Family. What's the message you'd like to express to the world about our connectedness as this country and some of its allies prepare to launch a massive assault on the people of Iraq?
You know, in the lyrics, it says one fair world family. I hope that you can see if there's going to be a future. We've got to learn to take care of the babies once again. This generation is too busy thinking of itself. If there's going to be a future, we must learn to think about somebody else. Ecology, human preservation, spiritual rejuvenation. And I see it that we must be excited about our ability to transform the positive elements of humanity in regards to the importance of Specifica Radio and the free voice, and celebrating that, getting people to understand that under the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, and our children will thank us, because from our efforts, we help to make a future path.
When you say we're all one family, how does that level of thinking or consciousness fit into the fact that there are indeed terrorists in the world who have attacked us?
Through our various factions and differences in communities, cultures, and religions, those of us that understand that the preservation of human life is based on us finding peaceful resolve have to express that. I do it through my art. Someone else will do it through education, through business, through science, through whatever areas that we can unify the voice of the peace movement. It's paramount at this time. The weapons have become more destructive. The intensity of those who have made decisions to rave terror have become much more plentiful. And unless we really advocate and find ways in which to connect, and that's where I see the technologies being important today, that we can quickly spread messages, and every day that idea is becoming closer and closer. Got to get in each other's face in a positive way and say, there's another way. There's another way to deal with these things, and lives lost unfairly is wrong on all sides and in all accounts. The energy that's coming to me now is in a collective that I've created, which is called Juba Collective, J-U-B-A. And I believe if there are aggressive attacks to the negative in regards to the promotion of war, then we must have very, very focused, aggressive movements in regards to the protection of humanity and peace. So Juba basically says, joined, universal, breath, ascending, that there is a need for enormous tolerance to gain understanding of our joint connectedness and the universality of our energy, which is breath, and that it is in a positive direction, ascending toward its highest aspirations. And through art and business and science and through all the various workers in this world, positive human beings, that we can work toward that joined universal breath, and we will ascend.
Juba.
Yes.
If you were to write a song for George W. Bush, what might the title be or a refrain?
Well, I would first take an old Negro spiritual, This Little Light of Mine, and give that message first. And then from This Little Light of Mine, I would go to The Point Is, Now Is the Time, a song by Charlie Parker, a bebop song. And now is the time to find within ourselves redemption of the higher light. And that would be my piece for today, redemption of the higher light.
One world family, hope that you can see. If there's going to be a future, we've got to save the babies. This generation's too busy thinking of themselves.
Cahil El-Zabar, composer, percussionist, and arts activist. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance this evening from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Jessica Kamen, Yolanda Turner, Keith Shalijan, and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.